Yeah, I hope so. Thanks so much for the introduction, Nathaniel. Thank you all for coming to listen. I hope I haven't falsely advertised here. As Nathaniel said, I did in graduate school work on a short-distance gravity experiment designed to detect or constrain the existence of extra dimensions. Since then, I've changed fields to cold atoms, and the main focus of my research group right now is not precision measurement, but sort of quantum control, quantum simulation types of experiments. However, I personally remain interested in the type of experiments that you guys are talking about in this workshop. And so I've tried to give a couple examples of cold atom techniques that might be interesting for theorists and hopefully will ignite some discussion. So I do not have a whole ton of slides. I view this as an opportunity for discussion, so please feel free to ask questions or ideally make crazy suggestions as we go along. So this is a quick outline of my talk. I'll talk just briefly about my background measuring short-distance gravity, because it was sort of what motivated me to go into cold atoms in the first place. And then I'll say more about the field that my group is in now, which is degenerate quantum gases, and just a little bit about some of the capabilities that these experiments give you. And if any of you guys are unusually interested, I'd be happy to give you a lab tour if you're still around in the next couple of days. My lab is just down the road in Broida Hall. So in the interest of being concrete, I'll talk about a couple recent experiments we've been doing in my lab. I chose to talk about three experiments, all in the area of strongly driven quantum systems, which are none of them directly relevant to precision measurement, but each of them has some connection, which I'll try to highlight as I go through those. And then in the end, I'll talk about some farther future ideas for how some of these techniques might be useful for metrology that could be interesting for you guys. And hopefully we can discuss some ideas that you have. So, okay, first of all, I just want to talk about experimental approaches, and I want to begin by saying a few words about this short-distance gravity measurement, partly because I think it would be super fun to do a measurement like this with cold atoms. So, I don't think I need to introduce to anyone here the motivation for looking for Yukawa forces at short length scales, so I'll skip all that motivation and just talk a little bit about why experiments of this type are challenging. So this is two expressions here. Okay, the force of gravity, which is very weak, and the detectable force in a resonant cantilever type experiment. This also applies to torsion pendulum experiments, or generally any type of experiment where you're using an AC force applied to a high quality oscillator to detect some interaction. So a lot of the challenge of these experiments is background rejection, because things that you traditionally think of as weak, like the Casimir force or van der Waals forces or Knudsen forces, if you didn't evacuate your chamber properly, are all much larger than the signal. Certainly magnetic forces belong on that list as well. Oh, we have some funny font things, so we may have some font surprises as we go along here. Those aren't meant to be actually P's. Okay, and then there's some, you know, if you're looking for a gravity-like force, a mass-mass force, which is, as Nathaniel said, what we were interested in, you know, a decade ago, then it puts certain constraints on the geometry of your experiment. And of course, for force sensitivity, low temperature is always nice, high quality factor is always nice, and low spring constant oscillators help you out. So I'm not going to go into the details of this experiment, but just to sort of flash it up, this was the general idea of it. We had a drive mass that looked like sort of a record player with an alternating density pattern of heavy and light materials that rotated beneath a force sensor, which bore another little mass. So we're detecting the direct gravitational interaction between these two masses. And there were various shielding schemes to keep electrostatic or magnetic forces from spoiling our signal. And the whole thing was immersed in a liquid helium cryostat and actuated with a pretty cool device called a gas bearing, which is fun, but probably not of much interest for you guys. So this is what the data streams tended to look like. We were able to sort of detect the expected force from a gravity-like signal, and then measure the actual signal on our cantilever, and then see how that corresponded to real forces. And so there was some, I'm just going to flash this and skip quickly past it because I did not update this plot. This is from my PhD defense. So things have, don't want you to look at the alpha-lambda axes. I'm sure that other experiments have chipped away at that on both the high and low distance ends since then. But that doing that experiment did motivate the whole team at Stanford and me to think about what the next generation of those was, because it was sort of getting to the limit of what we felt like cantilevers could do. And one natural candidate for measuring forces at short distance scales is degenerate quantum gases, partly because of the extreme control that people are able to exert over these systems. So what I want to do now is talk a little bit about these experiments, which are what my group now does here at UCSB. And I'll try to give an idea of some ways I think these could be useful for measurements relevant to the topics of this program. So I'm sure you all know what bosons and condensates are. The cartoon picture that we're all required to show is on the left here. I'm pretty sure I got it from Wolfgang. So a thermal gas you can kind of treat as billiard balls, and as the gas is cooled down, the de Broglie wavelength of the particles gets longer, and at some point there's a phase transition to a state where a macroscopic number of bosons all occupies the ground state of your trap, if you're working in a trapped situation, as we always are. So these are the BEC phase itself is well studied and not of much experimental interest anymore, but these are now very interesting tools that people are using to do a variety of experiments in quantum control, quantum simulation, and also precision measurement. A couple, I think, relevant things about these. I don't think this is so relevant, actually. These are ultra-cold atoms are famous for being ultra-cold, obviously. I put an asterisk here because Don told me that the event horizon of a black hole is at like 10 to the minus 50 Kelvin or something. I haven't verified that myself, and I don't think he has either. But they're pretty cold. So, you know, hundreds of picokelvin is not impossible to achieve in these systems. But measured in reasonable units, that's not all that cold. So T over TF, for example, in a degenerate Fermi gas is not competitive with even a high-temperature superconductor. However, these systems are really good at exhibiting macroscopic quantum phenomena. I mean, it truly is on the order of a million bosons all in the same quantum state if you're using bosons. And that gives rise to a lot of interesting possibilities. Maybe the most relevant for the purposes of this workshop is atom interferometry. You also have a number of what I tend to think of as knobs on a cold atom system, and that's what enables a lot of what I think are the most interesting experiments in this field, is you can tune the interactions among the particles, you can tune their tunneling, you can tune their, obviously, the spatial potential that they're sitting in, the form their kinetic energy has. You can sort of, by the standards of condensed matter, alter an insane amount of the terms in the Hamiltonian that describes these systems. So I think it's not an exaggeration to say that one has near-perfect quantum control over bosonic systems in the type of experiments that I'll be describing. And that control, more than the low temperature or any other feature, is really what I think might give rise to some of the most interesting precision measurement possibilities.
Is that middle picture data or simulation?
This is data from my lab. Ooh, I lost the tip. This is data from my lab. So this is a Bose condensate, and we sort of did a reverse of a typical undergrad experiment here. So you can diffract a laser off a diffraction grating or ruler to measure the wavelength of light. This is a typical undergrad lab. This is diffracting a wave of atoms off of a ruler made of light. So we put it in an optical lattice for a very short period of time and populated a number of different momentum states. And then the x-axis here is time, so you see those momentum states spreading out. This is a technique that is useful in atom interferometry, although in this case we're using it simply for seeing how deep our optical potential was. So to give an idea of what these experiments look like, I'm going to show some pictures of what we wanted them to look like and what they in fact do look like. So this is the design of our ultra-cold strontium machine. This is capable of producing degenerate quantum gases of, in principle, four different isotopes of strontium, including strontium 87, which is the richest one. That one's a fermion and it has a large nuclear spin. And that's also the isotope that Junyi uses in these fabulous clock experiments that I'm sure you guys have already heard about as part of this program. All of these isotopes have exhibit intercombination line transitions, which are transitions between a singlet state and a triplet state, which are forbidden according to the dipole approximation, but proceed due to spin orbit coupling in the atom. So these are very narrow optical transitions, and the narrowness of that high energy transition is like a really sharp knife that every strontium atom is carrying around in its back pocket. So that also is a feature of this atom that lets you plan some experiments that certainly qualify as high precision, although most of that is not what my group is doing at the moment. Maybe I won't say so much about that third bullet point. So this is sort of the design of the machine. I'll show in a moment what the purpose of all these different parts are. But here's a picture of the machine sitting in my lab before many of the optics were installed, so you can still kind of see the shape of the machine in the background there. And in the foreground are some of the resonant lasers that we use to prepare the atoms. So there's a picture of the other machine in our lab that I want to show you just to describe super quickly how these experiments work. So in some sense, this is, and this is obviously not a real picture, but a picture of our design. In some sense, these experiments are the grandchildren of the molecular beam experiments done by people like Norman Ramsey many decades ago. Because what we have here is an oven where we heat up a gas of atoms, in this case lithium-7 atoms. They make a beam which propagates down a long tube. We cool them longitudinally and transversely as they propagate, and then trap them in this chamber here, which is under a very high vacuum thanks to a combination of pumps. And there we subject the atoms to a sequence of cooling mechanisms which brings them to quantum degeneracy. So that's the design picture. This is what this experiment looks like in real life in my lab. Also, it's not as tidy looking now as it was then. We've added a lot more junk to this picture. So I'll show you guys some data from these experiments in a moment, but I think it's nice to also see pictures of the atoms just to get a sense. So these are the atomic beams of strontium and lithium. They are glowing and look like little miniature lightsabers because we are scattering photons off them continuously in order to slow down the beams. But that's them emerging from the two respective ovens. A little hard to see here, but that's a picture of 5 billion lithium atoms at 1 millikelvin, which is kind of the hot starting point of our lithium experiments before we begin to do all the cooling techniques that get us into the nanokelvin regime and quantum degeneracy. And when we do that, the atoms go through a sequence of states that are imaged here. So we have a large, fairly hot cloud, 40 microkelvin or so. As we evaporate the atoms and compress the trap, it gets colder and colder until at some point it turns into a BEC. So it's a picture of lithium BECs. And I should maybe pause here and say, for those who aren't familiar, most of the data from a cold atom experiment, in fact, virtually 100% of the data that you see from cold atom experiments actually just comes from taking pictures of the atoms using things very much like the cameras in your phones, although sometimes a little more expensive. So that's what these are, is just digital pictures of the atoms at various stages during the cooling. And then this is a picture of a strontium BEC, kind of an old, bad strontium BEC, honestly, but the change in the aspect ratio of the cloud as time goes by in these images is a signature of Bose condensation. And then these iconic pictures of Bose condensation, I've plotted at the bottom here, these momentum space images that appear on the cover of StatMech textbooks now. These are the corresponding pictures that that we're culturally required to make of our lithium BEC and our strontium BEC. I think those are maybe among the first couple that we made for both those atoms. So this is a picture taken in momentum space, which just means that we drop the atoms out of the trap, wait a long time for them to expand, and then take a picture after everything has been projected onto free space momentum.
It's the origin of the red and the blue, or?
Good question. So the way that we do all the cooling and trapping of these atoms is often using resonant optical transitions. So lithium has one important optical transition at 671 nanometers, which is close to the color of a red laser pointer. That's that color. And strontium has two transitions. One of them is this very broad blue transition at 461. So that's that. You're seeing those photons scattered off there. And the other transition is the intercombination line transition I mentioned, which is there's three transitions there. But one of them is what Junyi uses to make what must be among the most precise instruments ever made by humans. And one of them is a little broader, and we use it for laser cooling. But it's still 1,000 times narrower than a typical atomic transition, so you can get to very low temperatures using that. And all these images, these are false color images, obviously, but these are taken using light of that same color, because that's the only color the atoms will interact with. Atoms are fabulously narrow band absorbers. Okay, so rather than try to catalog all the capabilities of cold atom experiments, which I think would be hard to be sure that I was being exhaustive, I'm going to just talk about a sequence of recent experiments we've done in my group, which I think highlight some of the quantum control capabilities that make cold atom experiments sort of fun to design and maybe capable of interesting precision measurement possibilities. And these are all in the area of driven quantum systems. So all these experiments, to some level, are exploring attempts to answer this question: what happens when you take a quantum system and make its Hamiltonian explicitly time-dependent, or subject it to some generalized shaking? So some interesting things can happen when you shake a system. This is an example of one that many of you will be familiar with from classical mechanics classes. You take a rigid pendulum and you vibrate the pivot up and down. Then for certain amplitude and frequencies of vibration, the pendulum will be dynamically stable in the upward pointing direction as indicated by this video here. And this is a well-understood classical effect. It's discussed in about a line and a half in Landau and Lifshitz classical mechanics. So, you know, six pages of algebra. It's actually related to the physics of an ion trap, though, pretty closely. A more quantum mechanical example of interesting phenomena that emerge when you shake a many-body system is this sort of line of work, which is of a lot of interest in modern condensed matter physics, which is to look at the behavior of solids, and also in atomic physics, atoms, subjected to very intense pulsed laser fields. And the data shown here is from the group in Hamburg. Yeah, good, I did credit it. Claiming to see the emergence of a room temperature superconductor when they subject a cuprate to a pulsed laser field. Interesting new magnetic states can also emerge in this in magnets that are subjected to intense pulsed laser fields. So there's an intensely studied branch of condensed matter physics and also of atomic physics that looks at the new states that can emerge when you shake things very hard. And the hardest we can shake something is basically by hitting it with a pulsed laser. So this is maybe the overall motivation for the experiments that I want to tell you about super quickly. I'm going to trip through these fairly lightly unless you guys ask questions, because I know that experiments like this are not the main topic of this program. However, I think there's some relevance to future precision measurement opportunities, so I'll try to point that out as we go along. So how many people actually know what a block oscillation is? I don't know how common knowledge this is. About 25%, I would say. So this is a fact about periodic systems, systems in lattices, like any crystal, that a static force does not produce acceleration the way it would for a free particle. Instead, it produces an oscillatory response. So if you apply a static force to electrons in a perfect crystal, they should actually shake back and forth like this. And it's easy to see why. What I've plotted here is the band structure of a simple lattice, like the ones we create in our lab. And if you imagine a particle, a BEC, sitting in the lowest energy state, which is the bottom of the ground band, if you applied a force to it, it would acquire quasi-energy. It would move to the right on this diagram of energy versus momentum. And at some point, it would get to the edge of the first Brillouin zone. You guys all remember from undergrad condensed matter physics that the right edge of the first Brillouin zone is the same as the left edge. So the particle then comes back in the other side, and you get oscillatory motion. So this is actually something that's quite hard to see in a real crystal due to decoherence. But it's quite easy to see in cold atoms. So this is something that is sort of a tool in cold atom experiments now. And it's nice, potentially, from the point of view of precision measurement, because it constitutes a force sensor. So the frequency of these block oscillations is linearly dependent on the applied force. So if your atoms are subjected to some interesting force, maybe due to some source mass that's nearby or something more exotic, then the frequency of the block oscillation should in principle change. And people have used this to make precision measurements of gravity, and people are planning to use it to do more exotic measurements in conjunction with atom interferometry. In fact, actually, the most precise measurement of the fine structure constant, which was just published in Science last month, makes use of block oscillations as part of its toolkit for achieving the high precision.
What size accelerations are you potentially sensitive to?
Well, it depends on how long your block oscillations can go. So you have some, you can wind up phase in the block oscillation. So if you can apply the force for some very long period of time, you can observe 20,000 cycles of block oscillations, and then your force sensitivity gets quite good. But it depends on the details quantitatively.
These are one-dimensional lattices, I guess?
I'll be talking only about one-dimensional lattices. Good question. A few thousand in the experiments I'll be discussing. And that's typical for cold atom experiments. So it's not Avogadro's number or even the cube root of Avogadro's number, but it's still sort of a large n limit for most practical purposes. So typically, block oscillations, although I said they're sort of this common tool in cold atom experiments, they're typically, in fact, always until recently probed in momentum space. So you can see the momentum oscillating back and forth. The original prediction of Bloch and Zener in 1929 was that the position of the electrons or the quantum particles should oscillate back and forth as well. That is often too small to observe. So
you mentioned this was used to measure gravity.
Mm-hmm.
that set up exactly?
I believe it was strontium 88 atoms in a vertically oriented optical lattice.
So it was the Earth's gravity?
The Earth's gravity, yeah, little g. Yeah.
And how accurately was it?
Does anyone, other experimentalists, happen to remember? I should know, but I don't remember. It's the group of Tino in Italy. And I can figure that out and let you know afterwards. But it was sort of competitive. It wasn't like more accurate than any of the other accelerometer techniques, but it was competitive for little g measurements.
It was a 1D lattice with like 1,000 microsecs?
Something like this, I think, yeah. Yeah, a few hundred at least. I was saying just now, as a sort of straw man, that people have always measured this in momentum space. And so what we did recently in my group was we found that looking at block oscillations with lithium, not subjected to gravity, but in a transverse lattice, allows you to see the oscillations emerge in position space. And that's what is shown here. This is a time sequence of images of lithium atoms with a force applied in the vertical direction, and you see them kind of sloshing back and forth in real space. And it accords well with our theoretical expectations. This is a magnetic field gradient. So the atoms have some magnetic moment, and we apply a force with external coils. You could also apply an optical field gradient, which would apply a force via the AC Stark shift. But the atoms are neutral, so you know it's dipole forces that you're applying, or gravity. They don't have any charge, electromagnetic charge. So this is fun for a cold atom physicist, because these haven't been seen before, but what is it really good for? So I want to talk about a couple things that position space block oscillations let you do that momentum space block oscillations don't. So one thing you can do that's just sort of intellectually fun, in my opinion, is map the phase space evolution of a block oscillation. So this is typical phase space with momentum on one axis and position on the other. And we can actually see these dots correspond to data. The atoms move around in this phase space under the action of a block oscillation. And you can separately measure the position dynamics and the momentum dynamics as time goes by. The other thing you can do with a position space block oscillation, this is obvious if you think about it for a second, but it was sort of a surprise to me, is that position as a function of time is energy as a function of momentum in a lattice via this mapping. So if you take these images, you're actually directly imaging the band structure of the lattice, and that's what this bottom graph shows. There's no fit here. The solid lines are just the calculated band structure of the lattice using independently measured parameters, and the dots are the data. So this is a little bit like an ARPES experiment in condensed matter, which lets you look at the band structure. In this case, of a very simple lattice, but it is applied as well to more complicated lattices.
What was the force of the magnetic field that you used for these particular values?
What was the value of the force?
Yeah.
It's a little bit less than a Joachter Newton per atom. Those are very small forces, but we shouldn't be too proud of that because it turns out atoms are also very small. So, maybe more relevant.
It was a magnetic field gradient. What is typically the magnetic field size?
Oh, it's a very weak gradient. We're talking about electromagnetic coils this big outside the chamber carrying tens of amps. So, you know, Gauss per centimeter is the unit of the gradient.
What is it in terms of acceleration?
It's sub g, I would say. All the ones that we've shown here are sub little g, yeah.
You mentioned measuring both momentum and position.
Mm-hmm.
How far are you from being?
Oh, yeah, okay, good question. So we start with a Bose condensate, which is a Heisenberg-limited state. So it has some size, and as a consequence, it has some momentum spread. And you can actually see that. I mean, the fact that... maybe you can't see it in these data, but it's factually the case. We start with something that is at the Heisenberg limit. I mean, the atoms are in a single quantum state. So to the extent that it stays in that single state as it evolves, we stay pretty close to that limit, I would say.
But you get extracted from the data you were showing? Because you're trying to get some B. I'm just saying it's a curiosity.
I see what you're saying.
Even fun stuff for quantum mechanics class.
Yeah. So this is the center of mass position. So we're really plotting an expectation value here. We have 100,000 atoms, and we're measuring them all at once.
Is that for the whole lattice, or just for one lattice site?
This is for the whole cloud of atoms, which is distributed over a number of lattice sites because of, it's not in an absolutely certain momentum state. That's a good point. What's measured here is really an expectation value, so it's the center of mass. position of the whole ensemble of atoms.
And how many oscillations can you keep and still see the coherence?
So people have done it for 20,000. I mentioned that number. We haven't done it for 20,000, but it's feasible to do so in an optical lattice. The thing that limits us is the curvature of our applied force fields that causes decoherence. But if you're using gravity as your force, the second derivative of little g is quite small. So then that's the situation where you can see, you know, tens of thousands of these oscillations.
What's the oscillation time?
Depends on the force. So you can see it here. It's very slow. This is, you know, 40 or 50 milliseconds on the x-axis of these plots. So, but that depends on, you know, if you applied a stronger force, it would go faster. The period is inversely related to the applied force.
So it's coherent over many seconds?
It can be. Oh, but when they did 20,000 oscillations, those were faster because of the force of gravity. Well, those were also heavier atoms, much heavier, actually. So the force of gravity corresponded to a faster Bloch oscillation.
Do you have any, like, internal decoherence mechanism, like collision? I mean, like, decoherence is coming from your source. That's great for small gravity because...
It for sure is coming from the source. We've measured this. And that's a great point. So we turn off interactions in these experiments. This is one of the nice knobs I mentioned for atomic physics and relevant for doing precision measurement. If you have something called a Feshbach resonance, how many of you guys know what a Feshbach resonance is? Not a ton. I'm glad that Dave and Andrew know that.
Our hands up. I mean, we you know.
Exactly. We don't really know. So practically, a Feshbach resonance means that you can apply a magnetic field to a gas of cold atoms and change the scattering processes between the atoms to be anywhere from infinitely strongly attractive to infinitely strongly repulsive, right through totally transparent. So here we've tuned it to the case where the atoms are completely transparent to each other, like photons, and they pass right through each other. So we don't have the type of interaction-induced decoherence processes that Dave was alluding to, which we otherwise definitely would have. Sort of interesting, actually, the way that attractive interactions interact with Bloch oscillations. You can see some interesting solitonic behavior, but that's, I think, well beyond scope here. Okay.
Just out of curiosity, David, did you use your atoms to really precisely measure your magnetic fields for these measurements, or
this
work you did, maybe it wasn't?
No, that's the best way to do it. That was important here, to trim the magnetic field gradients, at least. Earlier in our cooling process, it's very important that we have the atoms close to a magnetic field zero, so we also do have to very carefully shim away the Earth's magnetic field, although that's not so important for these measurements. But the atoms are good magnetic field sensors.
And I'm just sort of trying to blow this up into, like, the world's best Bloch oscillator. So do you have a constraint?
I support this goal.
Sure. Do you have a constraint on how flat your optical lattice is? I mean, that's
a good question. So that in principle applies another force, which needs to be added. So if you have, you know, if you have a focused Gaussian beam, which obviously we do at some level, that applies some AC Stark shift driven force, which you need to take account of. And that's not negligible here. So when I said the force was due to the external coils, it's mostly due to that, but you have to take into account the optical forces as well. And that's, I would say, a drawback of some of the precision measurement ideas using these techniques, is you have this inhomogeneous AC Stark shift, which is something that you would need to think about ways to cancel. And I have an idea for canceling that I'll discuss a little later. Okay, so this does work in excited bands too. This is a Bloch oscillation in an excited band compared to a Bloch oscillation in a ground band. They're actually both happening at once. And the excited band Bloch oscillations are much, much larger in amplitude because the excited band bandwidth is much larger. The tunneling is faster. So I want to say a little bit, this is mostly just for fun, so I'll say it pretty quickly, something cool that we discovered about how physics changes in those higher bands. So what we're doing now is putting things in what we, in lab at least, call the D band, which is the third band if the ground band is the first band. We can kick atoms up into that band and they stay there for more or less indefinitely. We kick them up with amplitude modulation. And if you use amplitude modulation at different frequencies, then you can put them up into the D band with varying initial quasi-momentum. So if you drive such a transition, you see dynamics that look like this. So what's happening here is we have some ground band atoms, which are Bloch oscillating in the ground band lattice, like what I showed in the recent slides. And then we have this little packet of atoms that you can maybe see that's whipping back and forth across the whole picture. Those are the atoms that went up into the D band. And you can control how much energy these guys have just by what the frequency of your amplitude modulation is that kicks them up to the top band. So
this length is the length of the lattice?
Or? This is, well, it goes on, the lattice goes on longer, but this is a couple thousand lattice sites, I think. Yeah, it's on the order of 1,000 lattice sites.
This is position space.
This is position space, yes, yes, important. Most of the results I'll show you are in position space, which is, maybe that's a sort of unusual feature of some of our work, and maybe relevant if you're thinking about things like radiometry. Okay, so the fun thing about this that we noted is that the dispersion relation in this D band looks like this, like pretty exactly. So the D band, the exact D band calculation is shown in blue here, and the relativistic dispersion relation is shown as dots. So what we've realized, if you believe that this is the dispersion relation that relates energy and momentum of the atoms, and that we are in a harmonic trap, is that we've realized a harmonic oscillator in the relativistic limit. So this is a popular qual problem. We don't have a qual here at UCSB, but if any of you are students at other universities, you should learn this before you take the qual. And it's, you know, it's not a very challenging theory for you guys, I'm sure. For me, I had to remember what an elliptic integral was, or to be totally honest, learn what an elliptic integral was. But it's not very complicated, and what you expect if you take a harmonic oscillator and bring it into a situation where it's moving close to the effective speed of light is a number of features. Obviously, the velocity saturates at the speed of light. There's a characteristic anharmonicity that's introduced by the relativistic effects. You get world lines or trajectories that look increasingly photon-like, straight lines bouncing back and forth instead of sines and cosines. And, you know, things that you guys would figure out if you thought about it for a minute, if you haven't already. Surprisingly, this is a system that's very challenging to realize experimentally, although it's been discussed theoretically already for twice as long as I've been alive. And the reason is not hard to notice. It's that if you want to see a relativistic effect for a harmonic oscillator, you better have a trap depth that's of the order of the rest mass. And for an electron, that would be 10 billion Kelvin or something like this. So it's a relatively deep trap, and for anything else, it's going to be much deeper. So the fact that the D-band dispersion has this exact relativistic form was sort of fun in terms of experimentally realizing this long-standing theoretical kind of toy model. And more or less, the punchline is we observe dynamics in good agreement with the predictions. So this is for increased energy from top to bottom. You see it starts out kind of oscillating sinusoidally. Ignore the atoms in the ground band in the middle. And by the end, it has it's kind of moving in straighter lines with a larger period. This fits well to expectations. You do see the velocity saturate at the speed of light, which in this case is 143 millimeters per second. The experiments are, you know, they're not particularly approximate as a realization of this model. We're actually sensitive to beyond leading order corrections to the anharmonicity. So there's a super old Nature paper that, you know, calculated the first order term, and that's this dashed line, and the full elliptic integral is shown here, and that's better matched to our experiments. We also observed some things that we didn't necessarily expect. There's an interesting breathing mode that has a phase shift of exactly pi with respect to the breathing mode for a non-relativistic harmonic oscillator. So this is all, you know, honestly, mostly just for fun. That is a paper that we have written, but I don't expect too many follow-ups. But maybe more interesting from the point of view of the goals of this this program is what happens if you, instead of just pulsing the driving to kick the atoms up into the higher band, leave the driving on. So this is very much like the previous experiment. We apply amplitude modulation that's resonant between the S and D bands, and we let the atoms evolve, and we see what happens. And so what happens is, if we don't do anything, we see the atoms block oscillating, as I've showed you already. If we do turn on that drive, we see this thing which really surprised us when we first saw it. The atoms all kind of stretch out a little bit like the Starship Enterprise, hence my students refer to this as the warp drive. And then they collect again very far away. This is 1,000 or 2,000 lattice sites on the other side of the potential. And then the dynamics is cyclic. They do the same thing again. So this was a surprise to us, and yet it can be understood relatively straightforwardly if you think in position and momentum space at the same time. Basically, the atoms are block oscillating up in the bottom of the ground band, making an avoided crossing to the relativistic D band, very rapidly crossing the whole potential in that band. And then due to conservation of energy, they get to the exact opposite side of the harmonic potential. They have the same kinetic energy they had originally because their potential energy has come back to the same value. So they make an avoided crossing back down to the ground band and make another half cycle of a block oscillation, and the dynamics repeat. So what this is useful for, I mean, this is, in my opinion, sort of fun, but it's also potentially useful as a precise way of controlling long-range transport of an entire BEC. So if you hybridize and make what we, I think, is reasonably referred to as a Floquet block band, then you see the atoms transport. You can then quench back into the static bands with no observable heating, and the atoms block oscillate on the other side of the potential. If you leave the drive on for longer, you see them go back and forth, and if you don't drive them at all, you see the original block oscillations. So for all these dynamics, the block oscillations have the same amplitude and frequency. The phase is shifted in some cartoony analogy of the twin paradox. What this illustrates is really the dynamics are coherent. So we're taking a Bose condensate, transporting it millimeters just by shaking it, and then observing that its dynamics remain coherent. So you can do this with other bands than the S and D band. Here we're hybridizing the S and P band, which are the first and second of the total bands here. And this lets you turn on and off Vanier-Stark localization and block oscillations using the hybridization. So this, again, real space block oscillations let you map out the band structure. So that's what we did here, to map out the structure of this hybridized Floquet band. So really what this demonstrates is a flexible tool for band engineering. And I think this is what might be of interest for future cold atom experiments that are interesting from the point of view of high energy physics, because it lets you think of some interesting possibilities in terms of gradiometry or enhanced atom interferometry. I think it's possible, though we haven't yet demonstrated it, to use multi-chromatic driving of this type to create topological bands, which may be interesting. And basically, I think this is a pretty flexible tool that worked the first time we tried it, so it's reasonably robust. And I'm excited about some of the future possibilities for this type of work in quantum control, but maybe also in metrology.
So what are the band spacing
We think usually in hertz. So these are the drives that we're applying to hybridize the bands here are kind of 100 kilohertz scale. So this is ultra low energy physics, as promised.
David, just to drive, you're applying like a magnetic field, constant magnetic field, to the atoms to drive them from S to D, I guess?
No, it's done with amplitude modulation of the lattice.
Okay, so just started to explore this. What about like pi over 2?
Not making a complete, I think that's very interesting. So what Andrew's referring to is you could make a beam splitter. So right now the atoms fully avoid this crossing, but that's entirely under our control. If we reduce the amplitude of the drive, we should be able to make a sort of 50-50 beam splitter. And that's potentially pretty interesting. That would correspond to a technique that you might call Floquet-Stuckelberg interferometry, where you could have atoms going across different paths and then re-interfering when they come back to another beam splitter. And I think that's among the possibilities that I have in mind when I mention atom interferometry there.
Does your data on the previous slide show that like what I would call T2 there will work? Like if you made a beam splitter out of that, they will come back. And what I'm imagining is half your BEC made this warp, teleport, and came back, and the phase is reliable?
I don't think it shows that about the macroscopic quantum phase. It shows that about the phase of the block oscillations, which is different.
Yes.
I believe, but have not proved with this data, that the atoms would interfere coming back, though. And I think this technique also, this is the thing I was referring to, that maybe at least to first order cancels some of the AC Stark shift issues. Because what you've done is you've sort of automatically taken the atoms and put them in an oppositely directed AC Stark force by symmetry, basically. They have to go to the other side of your potential because that's where energy is conserved in order to make the transition back to the ground band. So certain systematic errors would be canceled by this procedure, although not all. That was just sort of a lightning tour of a couple of experiments we've recently done that are potentially have some relevance to the goals of this program. I want to now talk about a few possibilities along the lines of things you guys might be directly interested in. So first of all, just to kind of repeat what I've said a couple times, I think these sorts of quantum control techniques are potentially of interest for new measurements. I already mentioned block oscillations as a force sensor. This is that value of the fine structure constant That's not only using block oscillations. That's really an atom interferometry result. Block oscillations were used in that case to cancel some systematic errors. So Andrew already sort of raised this possibility of Floquet block atom interferometry, which I think is interesting. And I've already discussed this a little bit with my colleagues Holger Miller and Paul Hamilton at Berkeley and UCLA. Another possibility that I haven't mentioned is AC experiments to look for things like a time-varying fine structure constant. So this is where I'm sort of out over my skis, and you guys can tell me whether these are dumb ideas. But it seems to me that the tunability of atoms gives you an opportunity to take a system with a controllable energy splitting, and just that's very has very limited spontaneous emission, and let it sit there at various splittings and see if you observe anomalous phenomena, like anomalous spontaneous emission from the excited state. That's maybe some kind of atomic analogy of these cavity experiments that people are doing now to look for axions. I'm sure I'm sweeping a lot of complexity under the rug by mentioning that, and it's also entirely sure it's not my idea. In fact, Andrei Derevyanko is the person who suggested this alpha dot, and Victor has worked on this as well.
I know about this book. We published a book on Cheng Chin about this.
Yeah, Cheng Chin is interested in this as well. He knows more about Feshbach resonances than anybody.
Yeah.
Sorry, I should have put a citation on here, but I didn't. But I'm familiar with this work. Probably Victor is better to answer this question.
Let's see, we consider it slow G. It was a long time ago. But of course you can use it for oscillating variation.
Yeah.
But initially it was for a drift.
So sure, but the oscillation might be very interesting.
Well, so what would be the observable? What I sort of think about is you're driving a hyperfine transition, and then it's whatever that frequency is. So that's tunable by applying a magnetic field. It's not independently tunable from the Feshbach resonance. So, you have to kind of work it out. But I think, the scale of hyperfine splitting in these atoms is gigahertz. And the scale of splittings inside a hyperfine manifold, where you could also drive transitions, very good coherence there, is, megahertz per Gauss, so that you can sort of select.
Any predictions for the alpha precision? I mean, is it...
Victor will tell you.
No, but it's not on the alpha, but it's mass involved, so measure
variation. No, I'm just talking about the value of alpha, actually, not the variation.
No, but see, the limits on the drift now is approaching 10 to minus 17 or even better. So, from other sources. For oscillating variation, it's just a new field. We just reanalyzed old data. So I'm sure the new data will appear, so we will see how good they can do it.
For the value of alpha, just the value
itself. For oscillating variation, because but nobody done so far dedicated experiment in a spectroscopy. There was a dedicated experiment in MED, also actually reanalyzed the data. So there was no dedicated experience, we just reanalyzed data. I'm sure if people will do dedicated experiment, they can do much better and cover bigger range. So far, the range of oscillation variation is from 100 seconds to year. So it's a very big period because we needed to know exactly when the measurement was done. And educated measurements, of course, you can go up to gigahertz.
Yeah. So my amateurish understanding is it might be useful, even if it wasn't fabulous precision, to scan across a wide range of frequencies and see if you can see anything there.
I mention it because, when people calculated the modulic moment of the electron, I think the limiting factor turned out to be alpha, at least in 2012.
I think that this measurement from April of this year has caught up with that just barely. Someone else might know better than me.
With the PDG and the air, we used to be 31.
So this is this reference,
right.
And they claim, I think, that it's now limited by what whatever not is not alpha in that measurement. I can't remember.
Maybe the problem. When you do calculation, you assume certain value of alpha. And where you take this value of alpha from? So basically, you need to compare different experiments.
Yeah. For sure.
Because when you have some power expansion, you need to substitute value of alpha where you take it.
Yeah. So this is sort of some random ideas that occur related to the topics in my talk a little bit. I I feel like there should be more such ideas, and there may be that I'm not familiar with. This is not really my field at the moment, although I'm a sort of interested observer. So you have a million atoms in the same state. Does that not give you anything that, kind of is interesting, apart from the, usual kind of being the standard quantum limit stuff? The super radiant effects, or does bosonic stimulation play some role in sensitivity to interaction with axions? And then this idea of attunable resonance, I think, has some possibilities in terms of the good quantum control that we can apply to these systems. So I feel like there should be more out there, but that's sort of what I have to, mention today. You guys probably have better ideas. I do want to, just at the end of the talk, mention another possibility, which is the idea of not just using cold atoms, but of putting different quantum systems together. So I want to particularly talk about two quantum systems that, experimentalists like to play with these days. So atoms, I've told you about. The good thing about atoms is they're all the same. It's an underrated feature of atoms. They're very controllable. They're ephemeral in the sense that our experiments never last longer than a minute or so. So they don't stick around for years and years in general, unlike ions, which can stick around for a long time. The other quantum system I'll talk about here is, defects, in particular nitrogen vacancy centers in diamond. These are good sensors. They're, people call them atom-like. They're really like molecular ions. They're very small, ironically much smaller than the atoms we use in, terms of the, relevant wavelength. They're not all the same because they have distinct strain environments and so on, but they do live for a long time because they're in a fabulously tight trap composed of carbon atoms in a diamond lattice. So there are some experiments, including, I think, potentially some experiments in metrology that could benefit from a combination of these virtues. So this is something I've been investigating in collaboration with Anya Jayach's group. Anya is also here at UCSB, and she does experiments with these nitrogen vacancy centers. And this is the most detail you're going to get on nitrogen vacancy centers in this talk. So you start to think about how you could combine these quantum systems to do something interesting. And the first thing you think about is, these are both optically active objects. Could you optically couple them together? Basically, no, for technical reasons, very hard. And you can think about doing it magnetically. These are both objects that have spin and a magnetic moment. Can they talk to each other in some sort of way when you have the atoms trapped in a lattice above the diamond like this? Basically, no. If you're optical wavelengths away from the diamond, the magnetic couplings are going to be less than a hertz in strength, and everything is going to be extremely weak and hard to measure. But there is another possibility, which is to just drop the atoms on straight onto the surface of the diamond and see what happens. This is kind of the kindergartner possibility. So the potentially interesting features of such an experiment are that if you have your defects buried not too far below the surface of the diamond, they are capable of sensing single electron spins on the surface, and actually even single nuclear spins on the surface, although that's more at the limit of current technology. Electron spins are, as far as I understand, relatively easy. So this opens the possibility of experiments where you transport information or quantum states from atoms to the nitrogen vacancy centers and sort of make use of some sort of correlated interactions between them. I think this would be a reasonable question to ask at this point, is why would you want to do this? Is this potentially useful? So we have some ideas for some uses that are unlikely to be interesting to this audience. And one more crazy idea for a use that may be interesting to you guys, which is to use this setup as a sensitive probe of interactions between the atoms and the surface of the diamond. And in particular, there's an idea that I'm going to make a beautiful PowerPoint animation of on the next slide, which is to do reservoir spectroscopy on the clock shifts near the surface, which potentially would be sensitive to any kind of exotic interaction that arises as these atoms get very close to the surface. And the interesting thing about these experiments, maybe, is that very close means arbitrarily close. At the beginning of the experiment, the atom is many microns off the surface, and at the end of it, the atom is part of the surface. So if you can sort of follow what happens to the internal structure of the atom as it adsorbs, potentially a powerful tool for looking at interactions during that whole process. So the idea is to start with a spin-polarized sample. In my mind, this is strontium-87, one of my favorite atoms, and it's also the atom that has the transition that is used to make the most precise optical lattice atomic clocks in the world. Some of these optical clock transitions, if they involve excitation and emission event, change the nuclear spin of the atom. So this is an atom with a singlet ground state, but a nuclear spin of 9 halves. So you can store a good bit of information just in the nuclear spin. And that is likely to be a degree of freedom that, once it absorbs onto the surface, doesn't get all messed up by interaction with the electronic environment of the surface, because the nuclear spin is protected and has a very small moment. So the idea behind this reservoir spectroscopy business is you apply a probe laser at some time during adsorption, which can flip the spin if you allow a transition. And then the atom is gone on the surface, and you can't tell if you made a transition or not. But because the NV can read out the nuclear spin state, you can ex post facto look at how many of the atoms that adsorbed are in the spin 7/2 state, and then determine whether you drove a transition or not. So here it is, the finest PowerPoint animation I have ever made. Let's run that again. It's half an hour of my life. So, okay, I guess you guys get the idea. You can shine the clock laser at varying times as the atom adsorbs. It's capable of flipping the spin of the atom, and then you can read that out with the NVs. This is going to be sensitive. This can be done. It's going to be sensitive to a lot of different interactions. Most likely, as the atom gets close to the surface, the dominant interactions are not going to be things you guys are interested in. They're going to be interactions with fluctuating spin baths on the surface and Casimir forces. Victor raised a very interesting possibility in a discussion yesterday that an experiment like this could be used to detect black body shifts. As the atom gets close to the surface, the black body radiation shift may actually be very different, maybe even tens or hundreds of times stronger than it is in the far field because of near field effects. That phenomenon is exciting to me because that's not very close. You get the sort of an infrared photon wavelength away from the surface, and you're probably not going to be too messed up yet by what is starting to amount to chemistry as you get really close to the surface. But I do think this type of technique is potentially sensitive to any interaction that shifts or broadens or increasingly allows these intercombination transitions. And it would be interesting to see what results come from such an experiment. I certainly cannot promise that those results would be relevant to things you guys are interested in. But it's anyway an example of a new tool and the type of thing that could arise from combining the virtues of different quantum systems. So this is the icon for this experiment that we used to try to get funding, and this is some of the, we have a little bit of funding, and this is one of the prototype experiments that Anya's group and my group have been working on together. And the first goal here is to just demonstrate that we can get the atoms and the defects to talk to each other. This reservoir spectroscopy idea is farther in the future. To do that, we need a polarized quantum gas above the surface that we can then drop and hit with an intercombination laser at varying times. So that's what I had to say to you guys today. I tried to argue that cold atoms are a natural tool for probing systems far from equilibrium, and that some of those, and gave a few examples of that work in my group. And I think that, you know, there's some overlap, although not perfect overlap, between the quantum control techniques that we work on and things that may give rise to new measurement capabilities that could be of interest for the goals of this program. So force sensing, atom interferometry, and maybe, as Holger recently demonstrated, just enhancing existing precision measurement techniques. And then finally, I talked about this moderately crazy idea of splashing atoms right down onto a surface and investigating their interactions with buried subsurface defects, which you might call adsorbate reservoir spectroscopy. So thank you guys for your attention. Thanks to my whole group for producing all the results I showed, and many collaborators, including especially Anya, who developed at least half of the ideas mentioned in the last part of the talk. And thank you guys for your attention. That's a good question. That's the sort of the kind of thing I had in mind putting that bullet point on this slide. I don't see why not. Do you see why not?
It's not obvious to me, but it would be very nice if it's true.
It would, because
you would have an enhancement of a very large factor.
Yeah, we have 1 million atoms. So you can get 100 million atoms, but it's hard. But 1 million atoms is easy. And that has not really been used as a lever for this kind of experiment so much. So I think that's a very interesting question.
you compete with macroscopic number.
What's that?
You compete with a macroscopic number.
Yeah, yes, but do you compete with a macroscopic number of bosonic stimulated?
Yeah, maybe there's some covariance that might help. So it's kind of covariant absorption.
I see. But you're saying you could do that in a solid as well, and then you get 10 to the 23.
The super radiant effect, maybe because of the quadratic effect on the number of atoms, it might help.
Possibly.
Otherwise, in the linear regime, you have too small number of atoms. We just discussed it a few days ago.
Unfortunately, 10 to the 6 squared is still substantially less than 10 to the 23rd. So that may be right. These are still small numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's interesting because it's a clean situation. So when I'm studying token, there is also a question. Because with this spin effect, to serve, it's very interesting. But you need to know that you compete with clean measurements of this effect. Here you have a lot of systems, but machine is, at least in our work, was obtained from a simple system. Of course, it's hydrogen, positronium, and the best limit was actually from muonium. Of course, they deal with a different iteration constant.
Ah.
It's a clean system. Muon plus electron. It's a clean system because it's pure electrodynamics, no nuclear effects or something. So for the absolute best limit, it was obtained from muonium due to theoretical reason.
Muon and electron in a bound state.
Muon and electron, yes, but it's for theoretical reason.
I see.
Electron and electron is a different system, and your system is also different. So it's just how you can compete with this experiment.
Yeah.
The only your advantage, you instead of some atomic or muonic range, which is very small, you can go to much larger range of force. But anyway, if the mass of intermediate particle is small, you have Coulomb-like forces, and after that mass disappears within your equations.
Yeah.
So the question how far you can go in a kind of separation of other effects.
I think that's the key question, and it's likely to be very hard. So the advantage and the disadvantage of that kind of experiment that I sketched out is that you have a lot of atoms on the surface. So you're interacting with a macroscopic thing very close to you, but that has a lot of degrees of freedom, which can cause other issues. In my opinion, some of those other issues are interesting on their own, even if they may obfuscate the precision measurement possibilities. But yeah, that's certainly true. When you get close to a surface, crazy stuff happens. I mean, my general opinion is that if you try to do any experiment, any physics experiment at all, better and better, what you end up running into is surface physics. At the end of the day. So this is a way to try to take that seriously and not treat it as dirt physics, but actually measure it.
And Vasil, probably your advantage is when you consider it on a large distance. Yeah. When surface effects die.
Oh, so above a micron. Yeah, so potentially, yes. There has been some work done in that range, because there you can optically trap atoms above a surface. So I mentioned to you privately, but I will advertise to everybody else, beautiful experiments that Eric Cornell did already several decades ago, with rubidium BECs close to glass surfaces at different temperatures. And he saw the thermal dependence of the Casimir effect between the glass surface and the Bose condensate above the surface. Just awesome experiments.
But it's not spin dependent.
No, I know.
You address spin dependent, so it's...
That's true. Maybe you could convert it into limits. I mean, things do have spins there.
So are Bloch oscillations only good for looking for constant forces, or can you also look for time-dependent periodic forces?
Oh, good question.
Because those are the kinds of things you would expect from like axions or something. It's just a question of what the time scale is compared to the time scale it takes to get to the edge of the Brillouin zone problem.
You should be able to mix some Bloch oscillation due to a static force with some Bloch oscillation due to AC forces and get some signal, just like in any mixing experiment, I think. Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know, like a sort of way zoomed out question, which is almost your first slide, you said the limit of a force, there's an expression with a Q and a T, a KT in there.
Mm-hmm.
And your second slide said something about like a femtokelvin or something. But we never actually quite managed to connect those. Like, is there some obvious reason why your femtokelvin never showed up in your sensitivity?
Yeah, that was relevant. That expression was really relevant to the experiments I was presenting in that section, which were the cantilever experiments. So that temperature was the temperature corresponding to the thermal noise in the first mode of the cantilever. So what does that correspond to here? I mean, so if you're imagining doing something with a hyperfine transition, that there's sort of no... I don't know how to define a temperature there. That's an interesting question. I didn't really intend that expression to apply to all the measurements discussed in the talk.
I mean, I know, I'm just trying to figure out. There's probably some simple reason why it isn't. It's because the motional mode of the whole BC is not that cold, right? It's not at that temperature, probably.
I don't know. It's in the ground state of its trap. So it's a cold oscillator. And if you then make it mechanically oscillate, you're starting with something that has no phonons at all. It's a really interesting question that I just haven't thought about. So let me maybe not say too many dumb things, but I think it's very interesting to try to make that connection with the cantilever or torsion pendulum experiments.
In your lattices, what's the energy scale for the gaps between the bands?
So it's sort of the transitions that we're driving here, as I said, are hundreds of kilohertz, and the gaps are, you know, tens of kilohertz. It's controllable. It depends on the lattice depth. So this is calculated for one particular lattice depth. If you make the lattice arbitrarily small, these gaps go away, and if you make the lattice super deep, these bands become, you know, more or less harmonic oscillator states in the lattice. So you can, it's a parameter that you can tune really well. And in the experiments we did, it's tens of kilohertz. That's, yeah, maybe that's sort of an example of the type of tunable transition energies that you can see in atoms. Although in this case, you're doing that by applying an external trap rather than changing something about the atom itself. You're structuring its kinetic energy environment.
In the future, do you think the number of condensed atoms may just increase a lot?
Oh, great question. Maybe. So the best condensates now are about 100 million atoms. There are new techniques, including using one of the atoms I talked to you about, strontium, which you could imagine enhancing that. So there's a group in Amsterdam, group of Florian Schreck, really excellent atomic physicist, who has already demonstrated direct laser cooling to Bose condensation. So he can make a BEC without any evaporation. That's a big deal because evaporation is the slow and non-atom number conserving part of making a BEC. So what he's working on now, and I don't know the latest status, is whether he can make a sort of continuous BEC source using a, you know, a spatial cascade of laser cooling setups so that he could kind of continuously be refilling his BEC. And then it would just be a question of lifetime as to how big it could be made. I think, that's one answer coming from the direction of my field. Maybe if there were real low-temperature physicists here, they would tell you that just get a bunch of helium and pump on it, and you'll have 10% of the atoms are in a superfluid state. And that's obviously many more atoms than we can put in a BEC. But that's a BEC with very strong quantum depletion. No, not nearly so clean. Yeah.
What is your BEC? What is your strontium BEC life?
I mean, a minute is kind of the typical scale. It tends to be vacuum limited.
Okay, so for get better in continuous loading.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that is interesting for our field is kind of combining cryogenics with these cold atom experiments. Even in a really kind of kindergartenish way, you could potentially get the pretty different vacuum regimes, which might enable some interesting longer-term measurements. Something that atomic physicists tend to be allergic to. Present company accepted in every case. But I think it has some interesting experimental possibilities.
Sorry, can you remind me for the 10 to the 6th atoms, what the size of the BEC is?
Sure, yeah, it's it depends on your trapping potential, first of all, and you can make a tighter or weaker trap.
Sorry, I guess, yeah, what's the densest you can...
Oh, that's a good question. So our BECs tend to be sort of tens of microns across, and density is exactly the critical question. So you might ask, why do we work with these... incredibly, I mean, this is 100 million times less dense than a chunk of silicon.
Right. Can you make it more dense, I guess?
Yeah,
question.
Why? And the answer is no. And the question is why? And the answer is strontium and lithium and rubidium and everything except for maybe helium do not want to be a BEC at 100 nanokelvin. They want to be a solid. And they signal this desire by if three of them get together, they form one molecule and one atom with a lot of kinetic energy, and the molecule falls out of your trap, and so does the atom because it has some gigantic energy. That's called three-body recombination. It's the reason that people predicted in the 80s that Bose condensation was going to be impossible. And the way around it was simply sort of dynamic. So if you just go to a really low density, the rates for those three-body processes go down, well, the rates for two-body processes that promote rethermalization stay high. So you can get to a regime, which is the regime where every cold atom experiment operates, where the density is such that you can see BEC without just making a crystal. And that is the limiting factor on density for these experiments. And I think it's a pretty harsh limit. Unless you think of some really exotic technologies like X-ray lattices or something, it's hard to imagine getting a whole ton denser without having problems with recombination.
So because you mentioned interesting question, if you have really dense Bose condensate of atoms, so distance is smaller than the scattering length, is it completely new physics problem? It's a completely different system.
It's maybe a little bit like what you've worked on with the attractive interactions, where you get this collapse, right? I mean, it's going in that direction. If you
maybe collapse, it depends, because if you're inside the scattering length, you can't apply a traditional approach, which is Gross-Pitayevsky equation, so on. It's a completely different thing. Is there anything new and interesting there? When you have a dense
The answer is definitely I don't know, but it does sound quite interesting to me, and it doesn't sound experimentally that hard, because you can change the scattering length of the condensate suddenly. So you could imagine making a very tight trap with a weakly interacting condensate, and then wham, step your magnetic field, and all of a sudden your condensate atoms are super strongly interacting. I think you could probe such questions, and that sounds pretty fun to me.
Thank you, guys.